Ingram Smith, Bud Elliott, back again for another episode of the Nolcast. Bud, we will still continue to try to work our way through some of the questions that we received earlier in the week, and we'll devote a decent amount of our time towards at least talking about the Boston College game. If at this point you're still listening to a Florida State podcast in the season, I don't think you're necessarily doing so to find out how we're going to be able to block a defensive end or tackle a running back come Friday night. So we'll have a little bit of a mixed discussion. Want to always thank the people that make this podcast possible. Louisiana Hot Sauce, three simple ingredients, one great product. They've been a fantastic support for us, allowed us to upgrade the podcast, increase the consistency, and honestly, not a cheaper, more budget-friendly way to add on to a meal or to just improve that of what you put on the table. So thank you to always to them. And Bud, let's jump into our preview/remainder of the mailbag.
Ingram, good to be back with you again for another episode. I got to tell you, Louisiana Hot Sauce is kind of what I would like Florida State's offense to be, man. Simple, and I reach for it fast, right? Because I know what I'm going to get. I call that play. I get it on the table. I put it on the food. It makes the food better. Let's go. Let's get into this podcast. Like you said, people probably don't want to have a 30-minute preview of BC, so we're going to go about 10 minutes of preview and probably 20 minutes, 25 minutes of question answering. We are still working our way through these great questions everybody sent. And we like those five-star reviews. We got a couple of them off last episode. We will certainly take a couple more of those if you all feel so inclined. So keep those coming, especially on iTunes. Ingram, Boston College is on a nice two-game win streak. They come into the game at 4-4. They beat Louisville at Louisville, and they beat Virginia at Virginia. Both teams, who they were not favored to beat, and they went ahead and took care of business. Now they were a little bit lucky against Louisville. They did run all over them run game wise. They still only had a 47% win expectancy, so that was basically a coin flip. Comparatively, Florida State had a 12, so not great. At Virginia, they actually had a 99% win expectancy, so that was their first game of the year against a Power 5 team that they had really put it together and just smashed. But they've also been blown out. Certainly, they lost to Wake Forest by 24 points. They lost to Notre Dame by 29 points, and it really wasn't that close. They lost to Clemson by 27. They lost to Virginia Tech by 13. Now, I got to tell you, there's a risk here of saying, hey, well, they're clearly a different team now based on the last two games. I think they may have found some things that are working for them, but we're guilty of this, and certainly fans are guilty of this. You can't just judge a team based on its last two games. You cannot ignore there's eight games on their record. All those games matter. We learn a lesson from every one of those games, and I'm mindful here. I'm watching the World Series as we talk in the background, and Corey Seager just hit a home run, and to put the Dodgers ahead of Houston and Justin Verlander. I hope you don't have that game on DVR. I just messed it up for you, but the Dodgers had a terrible September, right? And everybody's like, what's wrong with the Dodgers? Well, they're resting some guys, and there's some guys hurt, and if you looked at it,
how many did they lose to end the year?
It was a ton, man.
Like 17, something like that.
It was some ridiculous number. After they started out like 93-21 or some craziness,
right,
to start the year. And so, what was their quote unquote true talent level? Well, it probably wasn't 93-21, but it probably also wasn't 17 straight losses or whatever craziness they had there. You have to look at the total sample set, and ultimately here, I think Boston College is a decent team. They're certainly a team that is playing well enough to let Steve Adazio keep his job. But are they better than Wake or Duke? I'm not convinced of that. Are they better than Louisville? Well, they did beat Louisville at Louisville, but not by much. And we've seen Louisville certainly had let down games. I don't think they're better than Miami or NC State. And you think, why is Florida State favored here? Well, It's just hard to write off the talent, man. Like Florida State's more talented, and if you're Vegas or if you're us, it's really difficult to say, hey, I don't know who's going to win this game, but I'm certainly not going to let bettors or pickers take Florida State and get points, right? You're still going to have to give points if you want to take Florida State, and that's because of the talent level.
Yep, good point, Bud. Ultimately, you have the better roster. If you look at it, Florida State's roster averages out to be I don't know the exact number, but really you have a difference of a full star when you're judging most of these kids as far as the disparity of talent and stars on everything. But when you look at that much of a consistent gap in the two rosters, then yeah, you should expect Florida State, even with all the injuries and even with as much turmoil as they may be facing, that you'd expect the more talented team, the significantly more talented team, to still be able to go up there and get a victory. A couple particular people on Boston College's roster that I just want to talk real briefly about, Bud. I want to mention their running back that they've kind of fallen into being particularly reliable these past couple of games. And then Harold Landry, the defensive end, that is probably the most talented piece that they have to deploy.
Yeah, BC likes these big running backs. They want to pound you with the ball, and they've got a mobile quarterback who is able to kind of do a lot of the zone read and inverted veer type game. And BC's going to be physical, man. They pride themselves in that physicality, and they got to be, because they don't always have great skill, talent, and athleticism. The running back is A.J. Dillon. He had a huge game against Louisville. I mean, I'm talking 39 rushes for 272 yards. That is incredible. 39 rushes, by the way, is a lot of carries to put on a college kid. I mean, that's I actually know A.J.'s mom a little bit. She watched my gear for me at the opening. Because I had to go to the other side of the field. I want to lug all my gear over there, all my camera equipment and whatnot, and computers and stuff. And she was up there in the tower at the opening. And I was like, hey, will you watch this? Because it was about to rain. And when it started to rain, she actually brought my stuff over to make sure it wouldn't get all wet. So really nice kid, nice family. And I'm happy he's having a great career at Boston College. He's a former Michigan commit, actually. And their class got a little crowded. And I think he saw the room for early playing time at Boston College and took it, and so good for AJ.
Yeah, good for him. Anything else you particularly want to point out about the Boston College team, or things that people need to look for? And I mean, look, there's no element about this team that is particularly predictable, and it makes trying to figure out how they're going to play and how their opponent may respond damn near impossible. But anything else to look for come Friday night?
Well, I will say this. Their quarterback had like the game of his life, Anthony Brown, against Virginia. QB rating of 216, 19 of 24 for 79 yards. However, that is way out of line with all the other games he's had this year. Look at these completion percentages from him this year. 62 against Northern Illinois. That's not that bad. Granted, it's only 4.5 yards per attempt. 38, 60, 47, 67, Central Michigan, 43, 29. He was 5 of 17 against that Louisville defense. I mean, he's had QB ratings this year, 111, 63, 111, 77, 116, 89, 86, and then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, last week against UVA, 216. So remember that song? It's like, one of these things is not like the other. Yeah.
Yeah.
That was his game against UVA. So far on the year, Boston College is incredibly inefficient as far as like on a down-to-down basis with their pass game. In fact, their passing success rate. So how often are their pass plays, quote-unquote, successful? I can tell you, they are just successful 30% of the time. 30%, Ingram. That's 126th in the nation. Not too good. Now, comparatively, 75th in passing explosiveness. So they are like 50 spots better at creating explosive pass plays than they are at like down-to-down pass success. So from that, I can tell you what I think I would do against them. I would probably play a lot of cover three, right? And just make this kid complete some easy passes underneath and just show that he can be consistently accurate while keeping in mind I want to prevent the big play and I want to have an extra defender in the box to stop the run. Now, it's easier said than done, but I think that's probably the base game plan that you'll see Florida State use. They're also down a day, because you have to go play on Friday this week. So that's most likely what you'll see from FSU. A lot of cover three, maybe some man with the robber, the spy type deal, little one rat stuff. But to get to this profile here, you always want to make the opponent play left-handed, right, so to speak. Kind of like make them do what they're not real good at. And what they're not real good at is consistently completing passes. Not necessarily long ones, just anything. And they're much better at running the ball in terms of on a down-to-down basis. Last week, they kind of played backwards, but for the most part, that's how they've been. So you definitely want them to do that. And on the defensive side of the ball, it's a whole bunch of upperclassmen. I mean, look at their roster here. Starters, junior, senior, junior, senior, junior, redshirt, freshman, middle linebacker. Interesting. Senior, senior, junior, junior, senior. So all upperclassmen and one redshirt freshman on defense, like you mentioned. Their star is Harold Landry, the defensive end. He is an absolute freak, and Florida State did not block him last year. They won the game, but they did not do a very good job of actually getting on and blocking him. So that's not too good there. They also have a very large defensive end on the other side named Zach Allen. And Allen is a guy who's not a great pass rusher necessarily, but he is an excellent run stopper. He already has 12 run stuffs on the year, 6'5", 285. And that's going to make it difficult to run to the edges. So I think Florida State's going to have to do a good job running on the interior in this game.
Yeah, compliments Landry real well. Big physical presence at the other end of the other line. But how is BC able to go into North Carolina, go into Spring Lake, and get a kid like Landry to play football there with all the other options?
I actually don't know. I don't remember him much as a recruit. And I can tell you he was not like a like a 4 or 5 star kid coming out. I mean, maybe he should have been, but there's also the possibility that he's one of these kids who either had an injury in high school, thus making it hard to evaluate him. He might've been like severely undersized. That's also a possibility. We do see that a lot. He was class of 2014. He committed April of 13. Looks like Tennessee got in on him late with an offer in September, but other than that, I mean, he had Syracuse offer. He did have UNC in June. That was after he already committed. It looks like he had already committed before a lot of these teams offered him. 6'2.5", 225, so he's certainly bigger than that now. He's put on some good weight at Boston College. And he was rated, looks like, number 415 in the nation overall. So he's not inside the top 300, but he wasn't like a two-star nobody. I think he also played baseball, by the way. So that may be
and basketball.
Yeah.
He's a pretty good basketball player, too.
Look, sometimes what we see with these multi-sport stars, and I'm definitely pro multi-sports for kids. I think it helps them develop a variety of skills. But sometimes that does mean maybe you're not all the time playing spring ball, or maybe you're not playing 7-on-7 where you would get noticed more. Those kids can fall through the cracks. He also played wide receiver in high school, so that was interesting.
Sounds like he may be pretty athletic. I don't know.
Ask Brock Rubel.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
All right, we've exceeded our time limit for Boston College preview of 10 minutes. So we should probably note here that if you guys didn't know, we broke this news, I think, on the Sunday podcast. But Jacques Patrick is out for the year with the cartilage meniscus deal or whatever that is. And also, George Campbell's going to miss the rest of the year with that core injury, I think Jimbo said today. So that's disappointing.
That is. One other piece of news, not related to this year's team, but do want to mention, Bud, that do you see the deal that Telvin Smith just agreed to?
I didn't see all the details, but that's pretty cool, man.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know the exact details either. It's 4 years, $50 million extension. I would guess that probably somewhere between 18 and 25 of that's guaranteed. That's just a guess on my part, but that is a... Man, that's awesome. That's great, and that's a game changer for him and everybody around him. So it's almost like that 2013 team was really, really damn good. Wild when you look back at what those kids are making playing on Sunday.
Good for them, man. Love Telvin Smith. Hell of a player, hell of an attitude, and just, you know, a guy who was a great leader in the program as well. Ingram, let's pull up the Vegas line for this game real quick. And we will see that it is, I think, still Florida State -3, which is kind of scary in its own right. Should tell you this is no slam dunk for FSU here. And the over-under is at 47.5, which basically implies that Florida State will win, 25-22, right? Yeah, roughly. Mm-hmm. What do you got? I guess it's time for predictions. And I think what we should do is three things. Number one, what number do you feel comfortable at? Like, if Florida State scores X, I feel real good they'll win. Number two, what do you think the score will be of the game? And number three, what's your confidence in your prediction?
All right, interesting. Confidence in my prediction is pretty weak, to be honest with you. We've been pretty decent at these things for the past 3 or 4 weeks, if you go back and listen. I don't know. I've wavered all day. I've wavered. It's just hard to have any firm feeling with this team. I think Florida State wins this game in a low-scoring game. I'd take the under and maybe, I don't know, something like 21-15 or something, some weird BC score like that.
Did you know BC is actually running a much faster pace this year?
Mm-hmm. I did know that.
They are number 4 in the nation in plays per game, or in plays.
It's impossible to predict this. A part of me wants to think, hey, look, you can stop there. I think you can not have to overly commit if you have your two defensive tackles who buy in, and your defensive tackles in general. I think you can stop their run. I think you can force this kid to throw the ball. Like you said, I don't think necessarily the Virginia game is going to be representative of his statistics or ability moving forward. I also have real wonders as to if the defense wants to play, if this defense is going to want to tackle a kid like that time and time and time again. So of all the games we've tried to forecast, it's as hard as any, in my opinion. And that seems to be a trend that's probably not gonna go the other direction anytime soon.
I totally agree with you there. My prediction confidence is very low because it's hard to predict. Like, it's hard to predict the individual effort level on some of these guys on this team right now because you don't know where their heads are at. You got guys crying after the game last week. You had some guys who just kind of left the facility pretty early, from what I understand. And, you know, who knows? I think at this point, some of these coaches, are they checking out? You know, like, they got to know that there's going to be some coach changes at the end of this year. How much do they still care? I guess we'll find out. And we'll discuss that more when we get into questions. So my prediction confidence is low. My feel-good number, I think, like the number if you said, hey, bud, if Florida State scores this many points, you feel really good that they're going to win. I think it's 28. Like, I'd be very shocked if they lost a game to BC where they scored 28 points. But my prediction is going to be I'm going to go 23-17, actually. I agree with you that I think Florida State's D tackles are going to be key to this game. Boston College has seen some D tackles like Florida State so far this year. But that's not necessarily a good thing because Boston College has not done a damn thing when they've seen D tackles like that, notably against Notre Dame, who has Jerry Tillery, who's pretty good. And then as well, playing Clemson. Their offense was dreadful against Clemson as well. So those guys do seem to come to play every week. And that's encouraging because there's some guys, maybe not so much, but those two do. And I think they can be good against the run. I don't think that kid can be a good enough passer on a down-to-down basis against you. So 23-17, low confidence for me. Let's get to some questions, man.
All right. First one that we have on the list here is that Rick Ballew mentioned Fisher wanted to get rid of coaches last year, but the AD didn't allow this. Do you believe this? Do you suspect Fisher has ideas of who to bring on board?
No, I don't believe this. I don't believe it from the idea that, like, Fisher wanted to make wholesale coaching changes or something, and then the AD told him no. I don't know anybody else who believes that. No, I don't think that's true. Do I think Fisher has ideas of who to bring aboard? Yes, absolutely. I think he has to keep a list. Don't you? I mean, in fact, I think it wouldn't be surprising if he's already reached out to some dudes.
Yeah. Yeah, we mentioned this last week. I believe Jimbo Fisher has an idea of who he wants to reach out to, and I think he's got an idea as much as that he might have had one or two of the initial conversations that start that process. So we'll see. It'll be something that we have a lot of time to follow, speculate, and ultimately, that's probably – you're probably going to hear that from the recruiting trail would be my prediction, where you first start to hear of maybe – transforming coaches or guys that are going to be brought on the staff. So something to monitor. Anyway, back to the...
That's how we've gotten information, by the way, in the past. I mean, there's, right. Like that's why we've been good at it, because I have to talk to these kids, especially this time of year.
No, I don't particularly think that Jimbo Fisher had a desire, but was institutionally not allowed to move forward with that.
I will say this. He had to argue to get Charles Kelly a 5-year contract, right? If Charles Kelly was the guy that Jimbo wanted to let go, I absolutely could see the AD saying, no, you just like begged me to re-sign this guy for huge money and a guaranteed deal over 5 years. Make it work, right? But I don't believe this wholesale changes thing.
Neither do I. I'll put it there. Do you think it's likely that Jimbo makes the necessary hiring, firing changes, but doesn't fix his problems, i.e. fourth down math, tempo? What are the ramifications? Would Florida State be able to compete for national championships in that condition without a 2013-type team? As always, thanks. Keep up the great fact finding and analysis.
Ooh, that's a doozy of a question. Not to go full lawyer mode on you, but I'm going to parse this question a little bit. To me, when he says makes the necessary hiring and firings, to me, that means he's bringing in the right people, right? Not just another batch of yes men. And if you're bringing in the right people, I'm going to operate under the assumption that they are people who have some of their own individual ideas and that you are going to listen to them because you're admitting your mistake that you had too many yes men on your staff who nobody else really wants and that you are having to run everything yourself and you look like a madman on the sidelines trying to coach every single position. It's like that old Bugs Bunny skit, you know? Now at first, Bugs Bunny. Now at second, Bugs Bunny. You know? Now at defensive line, Jimbo Fisher. Now at linebacker, Jimbo Fisher. So, assuming he brings on the right guys and he has changed his mindset, I think they would definitely have a talk to him about that. However, if he just makes coaching, if he just makes the necessary firings but doesn't necessarily make the right hirings, or if he's not open to listening to those guys, then there are negative ramifications. Because the second part of this question is spot on. Would FSU be able to compete for national titles without a 2013-type team if he does not make those fixes? No. Because Jimbo's mismanagement of games is good for one loss per year unless he has a guy like Jameis to cover it up, in my opinion.
Yeah, at least a loss a year if you don't have just overwhelming, ridiculous talent to overcome some of the situations that you may find yourself in. So that's a good question. Appreciate the person that submitted it. Thank you for your kind words. But third question here, just how deep do you think the culture issues go? I've heard that several players, some starters, regret coming to FSU and have considered transferring.
We've heard the same things. Certainly. Although, actually, I've not heard starters.
Yeah, no, I was going to put that qualifier
no,
on it.
Yeah, no, we've definitely heard some backups, including some young guys who, like I should have gone to, you know, one of Florida State's rivals or, like, another good Southeastern school doing well right now.
Mm-hmm.
I have not heard that about starters. Look, I think that there are certainly some issues. We heard some stuff over the summer that you couldn't really confirm, like this guy was skipping workouts or, you know, these guys actually on the team don't get along or, you know, these guys don't feel like they're being properly coached or like they can't approach this coach or that coach. And those are all certain things that you put in the back of your mind. But look, we hear so much stuff, man, and you got to try and figure out what's true and what's not. And like, that's why we don't run with stuff that's, you know, not well sourced or just musings of somebody connected in the program. So, but I think there are some deep-seated cultural issues there. I think they began in 2014, and I think the only way you can really remedy that is to hopefully capitalize on a good class of young leaders and by making a lot of coaching changes, really, you know, kind of cleaning out this fridge, so to speak.
Yeah, I think that you got to look into something we've talked about consistently. There's no quick fix here. You've got to make some uncomfortable decisions. You've got to make a real assessment of people that you might not want to, and you've got to turn things over. This is it's just not working. It's not working, and it's pretty clear that it's not working, and you're not having the product on the field that you think you should, and you're not necessarily having, like, the summer and the periods of time leading up to the season are not where you need them to be if you're going to play at a super high level consistently throughout the course of the year. And there's no way that you get a real turnover without seriously changing the composition of the staff.
Agreed. Ingram, next one here. Is there a good example of a college head coach, quote-unquote, rebuilding his own top-tier program, like Jimbo will be embarking upon following the season, where the Noles will likely finish with the regular season with a record of 7-5 or thereabouts? That is a generous record, by the way, that this questioner is giving. 7-5. Okay. I think FSU fans would probably do backflips to take that right now. My opinion is that once the rot sets in at an elite program, a complete regime change is ultimately the only path to return to national prominence. Well, I'll tell you what, I'll let you go first. What do you think?
You're going to reference Notre Dame?
Yes, and I think that we are both thinking Notre Dame does indicate the complete kind of lack of other good examples of this.
There really aren't any. I mean, ultimately, once it starts to go south, it's damn near impossible to turn around. Just things get stale, and just like if you're at a company, things start to, you know, bother you more that wouldn't have otherwise, or messages start to not get through to people. It's just what happens more times than not. It's kind of human nature, you know. The exceptions are out there, but and this is particularly, I was having a conversation with somebody in the college football world earlier tonight, and he was talking to me that it's particularly true with strength and conditioning coaches, and Tommy Moffitt at LSU is the exception to the rule it's very rare, and Scott Cochran at this point in Alabama, but it's rare that you're able to, you know, have that same message and intensity and have that carry over for, 8, 10, 12, 15 years.
I agree. Now, it's also kind of rare to have a guy in a position like Jimbo Fisher, right, where he's a relatively young coach. I mean, Jimbo, how old is Jimbo? 52. That's pretty young, man. Like, not a lot of guys have, the resume and the timing to also rebuild a program, right? Like, a lot of times you don't get a shot to rebuild a program because, guess what? They're just going to fire you.
Right.
You know? But Jimbo has the cachet and the resume to do it. He's like, well, hold on. You know, I won a national title, and I'm one of the winningest head coaches of all time through my first 7 or 8 years or whatever. Brian Kelly, kind of the same thing. Like, he took his team to the national title game. Notre Dame is a harder job in many respects than Florida State is. So I think from that regard, there's not a whole lot of guys who really get the opportunity to do it or who are afforded the opportunity to do it. So I do think that is one of the limiting factors in terms of why we don't have a lot of examples of this working. But I think the guy's right, though. It is really hard to do this. And we said for a while, and we actually openly wondered after 2013, will Jimbo be able to win another one? Just because, man, it's so much easier to change a culture when you get someplace than it is to maintain it. And once that, like, goes back, like, it's so much easier to get from 60% to 100 than from 80% to 100. It's just almost nobody's able to do it. That's why, like, you look at what year coaches are in when they win their national titles, like what year at the school.
Real early.
And it's real early, unless your name is Nick. I mean, real early. We've done this before, but, okay, last year, who was it? Dabo was in year, what, 6, I think?
Dabo and Nick are pretty much the exceptions going back to Texas winning the Rose Bowl.
Right. Okay, so Nick did it the year before, and he got there in year 07, and that was the 2015, so that would have been his 9th year. Who was the before Nick there? Urban Meyer.
Mm-hmm.
What year was Urban Meyer at Ohio State?
Year 2? Is that his second year?
I think, yeah, it was year 2. Okay, so that's year 2. Who was before that?
Yeah, well, that would be that guy.
That would be Jimbo Fisher in year 4. Right? Who was before Fisher? Who won it in 2012? Well, that would be Nick, who is, of course, probably the best college ball coach of all time. Who won it in 2011? Again, that would be Nick, because remember, in 2013, he was going for the three-peat before he got knocked off. Mm-hmm. And then who won it in 2010? Well, that would be Gene Chizik,
yep,
who was in year 2, I think, at Auburn. So, you know, you think about that. Who won it in 2009? It was Nick.
Yeah.
08, it was Urban Meyer, who got there in 05, so it would be Urban's 4th year. 07, it was Les, who was in his 3rd year, I think. 06, it was Urban Meyer in his 2nd year. 05, it was Mack Brown?
Yep.
Okay, so, I mean, we go back more than a decade here.
Bob Stoops, when did he win it?
Year 2.
Yep.
Right. Nick Saban, when did he win at LSU? Year 4? I mean, man, I'm telling you here, there's a reason for this. Now, part of it is the vast majority of these reasons, it's just so much easier to flip a culture than it is to maintain it. What we're seeing is guys win national championships when they're very early to a school or when their name is Nick Saban. So, you know, we'll see what happens here, obviously. Urban's got a pretty good team this year, but and maybe this trend will change out some. Bobby certainly won it in different years, but that was also a different time. You didn't have these guys who are quite as, you know, mercenaries as they are now. And Steve Spurrier once said 10 years is way too long to spend at any one place. Well, I tend to agree with Steve Spurrier.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for taking questions. My first question is, at the time of the contract extension and guaranteed $40 million buyout, what was the reason behind such a large sum? I am puzzled that this was even on the table after the losses from last year, and seemed that the administration and athletic director should have been more critical of the results he had last year, especially after being so wrong about the team. Did they make this decision based on overall results up to that point? In hindsight, was this $40 million buyout a bad idea now, given that this season is headed towards disaster?
Okay, I think we are the only podcast and only website to first guess this, right? Yeah. Now, maybe this is because I'm a big baseball guy and I look at these baseball contracts, but everybody else was like, look, he's one of the winningest coaches for his age in college ball history, blah, blah, blah. You got to lock that guy up. And I'm like, you're kind of paying him for past performance here, and $40 million is an incredible bet and like likely to bankrupt the school if something goes south. You have to fire him. Other people either are too tight with the head coach as their source, and so they you can actually be too close to your source and you can't criticize them, or they just didn't really think about it critically. But we were saying it. I'm puzzled that this is even on the table after the loss of last year. Look, Jimbo Fisher was very much in demand, and he still would be. Again, there's an argument to be made here that Jimbo Fisher could be more effective now at another school because of how damn good he was as a change agent at Florida State. Mm-hmm. If you get that Jimbo Fisher again somewhere else, it would not shock me to see him go, if he were to go to Texas A&M or something, to have them win a national title in like year three or year four, personally. He's very much in demand, so they wanted to make sure they could keep him here. And so what could keep him from going somewhere else? Well, maybe $40 million of guaranteed money. That would probably help. Also, I think they wanted to put in some protections for themselves. Like if he wants to jump jobs, basically he had to pay out the remaining monies on the assistant contracts. That way, mm-hmm. Florida State could go ahead and pony up some big-time money for some of these big assistants Jimbo wants to hire, like Charles Kelly, without being on the hook for it if Jimbo wants to jump jobs. Now, Fisher had basically hit them up for money almost every single offseason, right? And he has Jimmy Sexton as his agent, who is a great agent and gets him a ton of money. And an awesome negotiator. But yeah, I think they were looking at the total picture instead of just last year. And personally, I don't fault them for that. I do fault them for the valuation, but not for the data set that they evaluated. You have to look at the total picture. Nobody signs a contract based on just what they did last year. If you're doing that, basically one side is just being really dumb. In this case, it would be Fisher. And he wouldn't do that. And certainly Florida State's not going to be like, well, we're only going to pay you based on the 2016 results. Like, what? No. You wouldn't accept that. I wouldn't either. But $40 million is just way too much, man.
It's way too much. And it's
like, do you really think Jimbo Fisher would have said, nah, for 20?
I would have a hard time thinking that Jimbo Fisher turns down $25 million on a buyout. But, look, it's – you know what? You and I, it's easier for us to be critical about this.
Also, the options. The options are insane. This was everything we thought about. This 8-year contract converts into a 10-year contract. If he wins 9 games, he gets an extra year guaranteed. If he does it again, he gets another year guaranteed. So this 8-year deal for $40 million guaranteed becomes 10 and 50.
It's a 10-year. I know this sounds naive as hell to say right now with the record that you have, but Florida State's probably going to win 9 games.
Within this deal.
That would be that'd be quite the story if Florida State were to win 9 games at this point. I think, Bud, it's indicative of, look, a guy who's been doing this. As soon as you thought about it, as soon as you mentioned his name, I thought about all the times that Tommy Tuberville did this with Auburn. This is a guy who gets to do this 3 or 4 times a year, sit across the table from an athletic director, and I think Florida State's athletic director is more than competent and does a really good job, but it's tough for one particular party who does this once every 3 or 4 years and a guy who has done it with routine and has nothing but experience of just milking the hell out of these institutions and is next level at being successful in doing so.
You mean Jimmy Sexton, the professional negotiator?
I mean the guy that's synonymous with the industry.
He reps like over half the SEC, I believe. Next question. Earlier in the season, Fisher hinted in a press conference that Coach Kelly would stay through the end of the season so that it seemed that maybe there would be a change. Is this still the case? How about other coaches? Do you feel that Fisher is capable of making a turnaround similar to Brian Kelly at Notre Dame? Are you concerned about his capability in light of his talk of inches execution and his comments to a fan? Do you think that if he sees ticket sales and booster contributions down, that he will wise up? I believe we answered all these questions in our last episode. So I'm going to direct you to that one. That was our post-Louisville Q&A. Next question. I'm actually not that disappointed with Blackman, given how little time he's had with the program, based on the assumption, which could well be wrong, that it's really, really unusual to progress in any significant way during the course of a season. Am I crazy? Seems to me that after this dumpster fire of a season ends, and assuming Blackman has an offseason in which he gets to know the system better and, maybe as importantly, adjusts to the speed of the college game, and hey, maybe gain a pound or two, he could be a pretty good dynamic QB, assuming good coaching. Am I wrong?
Man, I think there's a real ceiling there with Blackmon. Obviously, he's had a little bit of regression recently when it comes to turnovers, but kid throws a ridiculous ball. You have to love the point at which the ball comes out of his hands. Good luck trying to not knock down anything, bat down anything from that kid. And he seems to have a decent grasp of what he's trying to do out there. He's a freshman. He makes some pretty egregious mistakes, but on the whole, I like him. I like, from what I can tell, like the mentality of the kid. I don't know that I love my running back going down and trying to block, but I know that I love a running back that wants to do that.
You mean quarterback?
Yeah, sorry, man. Yeah,
quarterback. No, I think people knew what you meant. I just want to make sure.
Yeah, no, what goes through the brain and what comes out of the mouth isn't always exactly what we intended to be. But yeah, I think there's real leadership qualities. Leadership qualities are nice. Leadership qualities are made all the better when there's a real physical talent when you compare with it. And I think I still am incredibly optimistic at what Blackmon can ultimately be at quarterback.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Well said, man. Okay, we got time for one more. On a side note, as of the Duke game, I gave up watching FSU play as I could not justify killing 3 hours of rare free time to sit through that kind of performance. Jimbo and his crew have to earn their spear with me now. But I definitely did not give up listening to the Knollcast, as you really have done a stellar job this year. On a totally unrelated note, but during the Clemson weekend, FSU is hosting the Men's Collegiate Water Polo Championships. My son plays for Colorado, and if they win their conference this weekend, the Buffs will be headed to Tallahassee. In that case, I am steering them directly to Madison Social. Anyone who doesn't want to watch the Clemson game could have a lot of fun watching the water polo tournament. Just saying. Great sport, lots of nasty hits, and on a club level, no good coaching to be seen anywhere. So, hey, no good coaching to be seen on the TV or in the pool. All right. However, we cannot direct people to go watch the water polo tournament if it's during the Clemson game because folks need to visit our fantastic sponsor, Madison Social. Madison Social right there in the shadow of Doak Campbell Stadium, right in the heart of College Town, along with sister restaurants Township and Central. A really great spot to eat. Just if y'all are new to the show, and we certainly have some new listeners, so let's just fill them in on this. Madso is like an upscale sports pub, great selection of drinks and awesome food. Township is a really cool style beer garden, and Central is a nice Italian spot with some fun kind of creative concepts there as well. Not like an old stuffy Italian place, and some really good pizza there at Central too. And now their new bakery located in Midtown, Sodo.
Look, they've been with us since day one. We've been fortunate to work with them. As we always say, keep them in mind. It means all the more this year with the season that they've had. But quality product, great atmosphere. Bud, I thought you nailed it. Good to have you on board here. You're quite a resource at times on this podcast, not only for your football information, but also a great point about Parents Weekend and the flexibility and the atmosphere that exists at Madison Social and Township and Central is perfect for a situation like that. You're not going someplace where any particular party is going to feel uncomfortable. It's a great location, and it's something, honestly, something for everybody. So Parents Weekend would be one more time that we would encourage people to particularly have our sponsors in the back of their minds.
I also really like people watching on Parents Weekend.
Oh, it's exceptional. It's remarkable.
Man, because there's no real qualifications for being a parent other than banging, right? And like, so that just leads to a whole lot of different types of people out there becoming parents. And man, the outfits are just outstanding. Uh-huh. I really, like, if it wouldn't be so offensive, we would definitely run like a gallery of Parents Weekend shots on Tom Hawk. I would just send our photog out there. Just a snap, because it would be hilarious. Okay, that was a little off the rails, but we're back here. Back to Marvin Wilson. I'm pleased that Marvin Wilson continues to get more and more snaps at DT. Given he was the crown jewel of the 2017 recruiting class, please assess his performance thus far, as well as any insight from your sources on staff. Well, they're going to need him a lot next year because they're going to lose Derek Nnadi, and I think they're going to lose DeMarcus Christmas to the draft. I think he's had some good moments. I mean, he's shown some athleticism. He's certainly lost a little bit of weight, probably needs to lose a little bit more. Actually ran into Marvin's brother before the NC State game and got to talk to him, and he said he's going to get in today. I said, oh, he is? I said, yeah, he's had a great week of practice. They told him he's going to get in. I said, oh, awesome. There you go. And then I saw him on the post game too. He's like, I told you he'd get in. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, you're right, man. He had some good effort there. So that was cool. And look, man, they're going to need Marvin Wilson big time. He's a guy that has that incredible ceiling to his game. And you got to hope he can reach it soon.
A lot of opportunity for everybody on the defense next year. We've got a lot of spots open and maybe even new eyes evaluating the talent. So I've been impressed with Wilson. On a personal note, I love it when you get a non-traditional number on a defensive tackle. Obviously, we're probably all skewed by what Jernigan did in a non-traditional number, but having that up there just is pretty hilarious. And Wilson, from what I've seen, maybe plays an ounce higher than he probably should, and there's still some things to work out of his game. But I think there's reason to be optimistic, and nothing that doesn't support the hype that he had coming out of high school.
Indeed. All right, last one. I know Jimbo has really touted the GPS system because it cut way down on soft tissue injuries. My question is this. Do you think he has made the Noles softer? Or do you think this has made the Noles softer? Maybe the players' bodies and minds have learned that they don't have to push through things when they're really fatigued. Not sure if your sources have ever really talked about how they feel about the system, but it's something I've wondered recently. Well, I know there's some coaches on the staff who have bitched privately about it or complained. I'm not sure if I can say that other thing and keep this family friendly. However, I'm not so sure those coaches know, like, it might just be out of frustration at times if somebody gets hurt. I think overall it's a really good thing, actually. And I think that if there were negative, like serious negative consequences to it, you would see programs dropping it pretty quickly. But you're actually seeing the opposite. You're seeing a lot of programs adopt it. And what we're talking about, for those of y'all don't know, they wear these like man's ears or like bros, to quote the Seinfeld episode. It's like a sports bra for men with a bunch of like GPS trackers. And it helps to track certain things like what's your VO2 max and your maximum exertion level, what percentage of your max are you working at, how many steps you took in the practice, all those type of thing, so that they can tell, okay, this guy might be overworked. One example was Rashad Green. Remember that?
Right.
Because they were like, well, damn, why is Rashad Green not looking as fast as he normally would maybe on game days? We're like, well, that's because he runs like 18,000 steps to practice every day. And so they'd pull him out for a couple of plays. I don't think the GPS thing's a big time issue. No, getting players to show up to workouts consistently over summer,
and
having your strength conditioning staff really be on those guys as much as they need to, that could be a different issue.
Yeah, that's the issue. Look, every soccer team in the world practices with those things now. Australian rugby, I mean, they've become basically industry standard almost overnight. So I don't think that they've necessarily softened this program. I just think that, and I made reference to it earlier, and we kind of made a passing reference in the past podcast, you're not getting the summers that you need to, in my opinion, to really play at the highest level. And you're not doing the simple things. And that is the weight room on your sheet necessarily matching up with the weight room time that you physically spend in there. And there are just some things that Florida State needs to sharpen up in general. So I don't think they've lost an edge because of the GPS technology. And really, the situation for those is not like that somebody comes running up to you and tells you that you may hurt yourself. It's more like, as you mentioned, it's more an observation between workouts and the idea that you need to scale somebody down. So it's not like you're running and you're tired and all of a sudden somebody comes up, taps you on the shoulder and says you won't be doing sprints or something like that.
Exactly right. So, okay, cool, man.
All right, bud. That'll be a good look back at a mailbag. Still have a couple questions, and we get a good, you know, a steady stream that we kind of try to put away and we'll bring back out in the next couple of weeks. So just want to thank everybody. Like you mentioned, had a couple 5-star reviews after the past podcast. Those are important in really a disproportionate way for us. So if you could either share this on Facebook, if that's your platform, retweet it, like it on Twitter, or give us a review if you haven't already done one. Our numbers have been particularly strong recently, and one thing that's jumped out at me when I've looked at analytics is the podcast, the most recent podcast has been popular, but also a pretty decent surge of people going back and listening to the podcast at the beginning of the year, and I think probably trying to figure out like we have as to whether or not, you know, where things went wrong and where or not we were accurate in assessing things. So interesting to see people's listening habits. I went and did the same thing. And You know, it's interesting when you go back and you listen to yourself, Bud, you kind of wonder at times that you think you may be able to do things better. And I just want to let people know that maybe my performance hasn't been as good as it should be at times, because this is not the most comfortable thing to disclose, but some of our listeners have actually threatened to kill me. So that's been heavy on my conscience.
Have you received death threats?
I have. Yeah, I have. You know, there's things that I'd like to do better and have a higher product, but people have said they want to kill me. So it's made it uncomfortable at times.
Ingram, I don't even know where to start, man. I want to express some sympathy for you if this is indeed true. Yeah. And I assume it is, because there's no way you would just make up something like that, right?
I wouldn't just say something really stupid in front of a microphone and possibly back myself into a hell of a corner. No, I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't do anything like that.
Now, I don't want to go overboard with this, because, look, there's some chance that Jim McElwain was telling the truth, right? Some chance. I'm not some saying chance. It's a huge chance. I think there's probably a decent chance he was embellishing some. Like, I don't know if his players, him and his family, have all received death threats, or if any of them have, actually. Right. But there's a lot of people out there calling BS on this, man, including maybe his employer.
Yeah, maybe his employer.
We talked about this last episode, too.
Yeah, we did. All of his actions post making that statement make me really wonder as to whether anybody ever said that to him at all. I mean,
did you see what he said today?
Yes, I did. Just incredible.
For the listeners who didn't see it, could fill them in on what he said today with the unmanageable thing.
He said basically what I read is that he said at this point he has considered the death threats to be manageable, but at a time and place where they got to a unmanageable point is where he would perhaps want to call upon the school's resources.
Okay. You know, if I was a parent of a football player at Florida, if I had a football-playing kid who went to Florida, you know, I would actually prefer that a law enforcement professional or FBI agent or someone else than a football coach be the person to determine if the death threat against my son was manageable or unmanageable, right? Like, I'd rather you determine.
The football coach is making the assessment on the validity of the threats. I think that's a great place to put yourself in, Jim. I really tip my hat to how you've handled this and put yourself in one hell of a corner. And it may be a real gift that Florida was contractually granted there. Who knows? A lot of presumption there, and we'll have to see how they finish. But I don't think that's played well in any aspect of the fan base, and certainly has not done anything to unify what was a pretty fractional fan base behind the head coach as was.
Yeah, man. I mean, it's like, you got some Gator friends, right? I actually have a lot of Florida friends.
Mm-hmm. Certainly.
I don't know any of them who wanted to keep McElwain.
I had a couple older Gator fans that were still supportive of him, and it just enjoyed, you know, winning the East. And not saying that they thought that was acceptable or that's where that program had kind of reset the expectations, but they were willing to give him more. But a lot of the fan base is basically interpreting this as like, this guy had a tough week and maybe didn't fully conscientiously mean to do this, but basically blame the fans perhaps for the season not necessarily going the way he would want it to over the past 4 or 5 weeks.
Yeah. By the way, there's something happening Saturday that you remember. There's a line in Star Wars, right? Obi-Wan Kenobi says, "That's no moon; it's a space station." And then Han says, "It's too big to be a space station." And Luke Skywalker says, "I have a very bad feeling about this. That's Georgia."
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's the Death Star that Kirby Smart's building in the SEC East.
Yeah.
And that the lens through which all athletic directors view their teams in the SEC East after Saturday could significantly change, right? Like, that could be a really important game for the future of college football in Florida. Because if you're Florida and you see that Kirby Smart in year three has just absolutely or in year two has just lapped Jim McElwain in year three,
yeah,
you're not real happy about that. By the way, that A&M Mississippi State game could be very impactful for
football. It'll be as important as anything that goes on for Florida State this weekend. We'll see.
And with that, this concludes this episode of The Knollcast. Make sure to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, write us at thenollcast@gmail.com, or tweet us at Knollcast. All right, so BC, I'm going 24-16, Florida State. It's never really going to feel close, but by the end of the game, you're going to look at the score, you're going to wonder why you follow this team. That's what I think. Today's date is October 26th, 2017, for Ingram Smith and Bud Elliott. This is your producer, Judson Wright, signing out. Thank you.